Welcome to On DoD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Now your host, Jared Serbu.
Thanks for listening to Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. It is 5 minutes past the hour. I'm Jared Serbu. Welcome to another edition of On DoD. This week, a focus on disability programs in the Department of Defense. In compliance with recent executive orders from the Obama White House, the Pentagon says it wants to be a model employer for Americans with disabilities, both those who've served in uniform and those who haven't. On today's show, we have two guests who are in charge of making that happen. Later in the hour, we'll be talking with Dinah Cohen. She's the director of DOD's Computer Electronic Accommodations Program, the office that's in charge of providing assistive technology to not just DOD, but 5 dozen agencies across government. But our first guest is Stephen King, DOD's director of disability programs. He's in charge of implementing Executive Order 13548 across DOD, managing the department's workforce recruitment program for college grads with disabilities, and several other duties, including recognizing both people and DOD agencies who've excelled in the area of disability employment. The Pentagon did just that with an award ceremony in early December. We begin our discussion there.
We recognized or highlighted the success and efforts of 17 DOD employees and service members with disabilities, and we also recognized 4 DOD components, DOD agencies, for their efforts in removing barriers to the employment of individuals with disabilities.
Let's start with the individual employees, 17 you said.
Correct.
Characterize what sorts of things they did or accomplished to earn this recognition.
Well, in looking at the nominations that were submitted by the DOD agencies, I did see a common thread. The 17 individuals recognized, combined, collectively, had over 300 years of federal government experience, most of that with DOD, either as civilians or members of the military. These are individuals who are very loyal to the federal government. They want to be federal government employees, and they also want to succeed. Sometimes when we have these award ceremonies, you see a large number of individuals who have done something outstanding, a recent task or project that they worked on. With this group, more than maybe some of the ones I've seen in the past, it was a history of excellence or success, and that impressed me a great deal. These individuals collectively give back to their communities, and many of them actually serve as mentors to other individuals with disabilities to help prepare them for what they may experience in the workplace. And that says a lot about the excellence that was highlighted in these 17 individuals who were recognized at the award ceremony.
So let's move on to some of the components that won awards. Tell me who your winners were here and what they did.
The Department of Air Force won for the Military Department Award. They have made a lot of progress in resurveying their workforce, and that they actually went out to their workforce and made them aware of the importance of disclosing their disability. They educated their workforce on how that information is going to be used. That led to more people feeling comfortable disclosing the nature of their disability, which in turn led to a higher participation rate, a representation of individuals within their workplace. One thing I could say about Air Force that really helped them stand out as well is that they have been rather progressive. They've assessed what they've done in the past, and then they've tried to think outside the box to figure out ways in which they could approach things in a different manner, creatively. I was very glad to see that, very well deserving. The National Security Agency won for the best intelligence component. National Security Agency actually has a history of doing very well in this area. They are known for employing individuals with severe or targeted disabilities. These are the disabilities that the EEOC has indicated agencies must place special emphasis upon. The NSA has, for a long period of time, done very, very successful in this area. Our mid-size component award winner was the Defense Logistics Agency. And if any one agency has dominated their category over the last 10 to 15 years, it's DLA. They use hiring flexibility such as the Schedule A appointing authority, which permits federal government agencies to hire individuals with disabilities non-competitively. They use that at a very high rate. They've had a lot of success in addressing barriers to employment of people with disabilities, addressing attitudinal barriers, and they also are one of our greatest supporters of the Workforce Recruitment Program, which is a federal-wide program to attract individuals, college students, and recent graduates with disabilities to the federal government workforce. The Defense Technical Information Center was actually our best small size component award winner. They really excelled this year. In part through their efforts, DOD has gone from hiring or actually having on board a participation rate of individuals with severe or targeted disabilities of around 0.75%, and that has actually remained constant. We have a lot of progress we need to make, but if other agencies within DOD would look at the example that is set by the four component award winners, I am rather confident that we can make progress in the future.
And when you see an organization that's worthy of recognition in this way, are there common threads that you see? I mean, is it a matter of having a dedicated person that emphasizes that this is important in the leadership chain? How do individual components or DOD agencies succeed in doing what you want them to do?
It certainly requires support from the top. The Department of Air Force, for example, their leadership have shown great interest in doing what they can to be a model employer of individuals with disabilities as required under the executive order and also under the Rehabilitation Act. They have put in place initiatives and efforts to increase hiring of individuals with disabilities, including veterans with a disability rating of 30% or greater. They're also increasing their use in the Schedule A Appointing Authority and the Workforce Recruitment Program that I had mentioned. None of that would be possible, not only without the support of their senior leaders, but also their dedicated HR and EEO professionals. Sometimes within federal government agencies, you see some of an adversarial relationship between human resources personnel and equal employment opportunity offices. And I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that when complaints are filed, a lot of times they are based on hiring actions. Mm-hmm. Well, then you have the EEO professionals having to investigate actions that may have been performed by the personnel office. So that does indeed sometimes create an adversarial relationship. The agencies that were recognized for their efforts have moved beyond that. They're actually working in partnership with each other, reaching out across the aisle and working together, because to recruit a diverse workforce and to ensure that we remove barriers to the advancement, retention, et cetera, of individuals with disabilities, it can't be done by one office. It has to be done with management leadership as well as HR, EEO professionals working hand in hand, and also the support of the hiring managers. They're the folks who actually make the hiring decisions, and without their support, we would never make any progress whatsoever.
I want to start talking about some of the various aspects of disability hiring that you've mentioned over the past several minutes, starting with special hiring authorities. Can you describe some of those authorities that are available?
The hiring authority that we are focused on the most right now is really the Schedule A Appointing Authority. Schedule A Appointing Authority allows federal government agencies to hire individuals with certain types of disabilities non-competitively. Those categories are individuals with severe physical disabilities, individuals with psychiatric disabilities or mental disabilities, and also individuals who have intellectual disabilities. Agencies can hire individuals who fall into those categories as long as they're qualified. They can actually hire them non-competitively without having to post a job or vacancy announcement. Over the past 2 years, DOD has seen a rather drastic increase in the use of the Schedule A Appointing Authority, going from less than 0.25% of our hires to most recently almost 1% of our hires.
You're talking about across the board, the entire civilian workforce, 1% of it is made up of people that came through these authorities?
Correct. And that's not including other hiring authorities. We also, as you're probably aware, have veterans hiring authorities that are specifically targeting veterans who have disability ratings of 30% or greater. That's not even including our service members or veterans who come in under that authority, because then our numbers would go even higher. Because Department of Defense is one of the best, if not the best, agency at hiring veterans.
This may sound like an ignorant or an insensitive question, but is it ever a concern that people may exaggerate, make up disabilities in order to get in the door under one of these special hiring authorities, or that hiring managers may sort of do some of the same mm-hmm. thing, exaggerate mm-hmm. or falsify disabilities in order to meet some quota that's out there?
I think that's a great question. It's a question I've heard before, a concern that's been shared with me before. When you look at our statistics over the past fiscal year, for example, our use of the Schedule A Appointing Authority, although it represents just under 1%, we're talking about ultimately, say, 400 hires using the Schedule A Appointing Authority. If there was fraud, widespread fraud in the use of an appointing authority, we would actually, I believe, see those numbers much higher and understand that there are safeguards in place. There is specific documentation that must be provided. It is up to the human resources professionals to verify the information that they receive to make sure that it's valid, just as they would with, for example, official transcripts. And our HR professionals are quite well educated in schools on what to look for and what documentation is acceptable. And I believe that they are following the regulations and guidelines appropriately.
Stephen King is our guest for the first half of today's program. He is the Director of Disability Programs for the Department of Defense. We'll talk more after a short break. This is On DOD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Jared Serbu. Back on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Jared Serbu. This is On DOD. Talking in the first half of today's show with Stephen King, DOD's Director of Disability Programs. For the break, we were discussing some of the accomplishments of various DOD components the department's recognizing in the area of disability employment. We pick up that conversation now.
You mentioned earlier that the Air Force was recognized for encouraging the disclosure of disabilities. Talk a little bit about why that's important, what those disclosures are used for, if you will.
Okay. When the Department of Air Force decided to go out and survey, if you will, their workforce, they didn't actually call it a survey. They called it a verification of disability status code. We have, when federal government employees come on board, they are asked to fill out a standard OPM form called the Standard Form 256, Self-Identification of Disability. That form is gathered. Very few people within an organization ever have access to this information. The information is entered into our personnel data system. Existing employees, once you've come on board and you have access to our electronic personnel data system, we all have the ability and the privacy and confidentiality, et cetera, that's afforded by this system, we have the ability to change our code at our desk without anyone knowing it. It's only for statistical purposes. Well, when we looked department-wide, when we looked at the number of employees who were on our payrolls over 10 years ago versus more recently, so individuals who stayed on our payrolls for a 10-year period, we saw that very few people actually changed their disability status code over a 10-year period. Now, as you age, you're more likely to acquire a disability. So we actually thought that the number would be more significant than it was. That made us realize that maybe we need to encourage DOD agencies to remind employees of the importance of verifying the codes that are carried within our systems. How do we use this information? The information is used to create reports that go to the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, OPM, the White House, et cetera. We use it, however, at the component level and within DOD to make sure that we have the services, programs, et cetera, that are necessary to support someone throughout their employment life cycle. I may not have a disability today. In case of some employees, they may be thinking, I don't have a disability today. Why do I need to disclose? Well, just because you don't have a disability today doesn't mean you're not going to have one later. And as a disability program manager, it's important for me to be able to take workforce data, accurate workforce data, to my leaders and say, look, over the last 5 years, we've seen an increase in the participation rate or representation of individuals who are deaf or hard of hearing. That is possibly the documentation, the statistics that I need to then potentially try to secure a staff sign language interpreter. A lot of times we contract, and we actually work with contract sign language interpreters, but maybe if we showed that we have a particular need in an area based
tells
on
what the demand signals are.
Exactly.
And
that's important. We want to make sure that we're using our resources efficiently and effectively, and having strong workforce data, accurate workforce data, is a significant part of us being able to do that and doing that well.
You clearly think DOD has made progress in this area and is continuing to. Given that, what would you say your biggest challenges in this job are right now for the entire department?
I think, for one, in continuing to encourage people to disclose and explaining to them the importance of it, that we truly do want to be a model employer, that we want to be there for them today and in the future as their life changes and as their needs change. I think that's extremely important. We've made progress on, for example, addressing some of manager's potential concerns. Let's face it, when you hire someone who's different than you, and you may be thinking, well, hold on, I'm going to have to manage this person a little bit differently. Mm-hmm. Some managers are intimidated by that. So what we're trying to do, and I think something we're doing rather effectively within the Department of Defense, is roll out training not only for our disability program managers, because people such as myself, I can't be everywhere. I can't be in each manager's office talking to them about this. But we have a vast cadre of dedicated disability program managers throughout all of our DOD agencies and components. And we've taught them how to address these issues, these attitudinal issues potentially, to make our managers aware of what people with disabilities can do and what value they do add to our organization. So it's an area in which we do need to make progress, but we already are, I think, making some progress. We just need to do more. We've also incorporated training, disability awareness training, in the training that has been established for new supervisors. And currently there is training being developed, a refresher training course for our more seasoned managers. And we will have a module on employment of people with disabilities in that training as well. So I think we have the right mix of education and awareness going on within the department. And I believe that it's certainly going to show results.
And when you communicate with hiring managers out there in the field, what's the message about sort of why? It's important to hire people with disabilities, fill in the blank.
I have to tell you a personal story. About 10 years ago, I went to a federal government conference focused on employment of people with disabilities. And there was a professional from, I believe it was a major corporation on stage, and she talked about how being an executive within this organization, the stress that she was under, the demands of the job, et cetera, because I believe she was a marketing executive. And she then talked about an automobile accident that she was in. And I left something out. She actually was in a wheelchair. She actually used a wheelchair. And she talked about how her life was prior and what it's like today. And she said, you know, where I came from to now, every morning waking up, you know, my biggest challenge each day is just getting out of bed on my own. My greatest challenge every day is brushing my own hair. It really changed her perspective on life and on her career. Well, that got me thinking. I don't know about you, but I want people like that working for me. I want people working for me that use their skill, their life experience in making what I do better and advancing the mission of our organization. We need people from all different types of backgrounds. We know at Department of Defense that our strength is in the diversity of our civilian employees and our military. And this really just gets at the heart of the importance of diversity. I want someone who can come in, who can look at issues that others may think are barriers and say, you know what? No, I made it to work today. I made it to work today. I brushed my own hair today. That's the value that I think people with disabilities bring to the workplace, and that's the message that I try to deliver to managers.
The characteristics that you just talked about, I think, are embedded pretty deeply in this generation of wounded warriors that are coming back and looking to get hired potentially by the government. How does the way that you manage these programs operate differently for them to the extent, if it does at all? I mean, and how is the department responding to this influx of people who are leaving uniform and
right,
potentially coming into civilian service?
Well, as I mentioned, individuals with disabilities have certain skills, usually because of their own life experiences, et cetera. You add to that another layer when you're talking about our veterans, those who have served in the United States military. They also have the leadership skills. They understand our culture. They're used to getting things done, and they know how to get things done within the Department of Defense, which isn't easy, by the way, at times. We're a huge organization. To have both of those layers in one person, they're invaluable to our efforts. And what we try to do is ease their transition into the civilian service. You know, not everyone can continue to serve after they've acquired an injury of some sort. But we would like for our wounded warriors to remain part of the DOD family, if at all possible. And we do that by supporting them through efforts such as the Computer Electronic Accommodations Program. They have a Wounded Service Members Initiative in which they can provide assistive technology to service members prior to them transitioning, actually, so they can become aware of the technology that may assist them in doing their job in the future. We want to allow our wounded warriors to remain part of the organization if they choose to. And we have programs, initiatives, and efforts in place to assist them with that and to assist them in finding the right DOD civilian career if that's what they want to do. However, maybe some of our wounded warriors do not want to remain part of our family, but our responsibility doesn't end there. Then we also are willing to try to do what we can to partner with our other federal government agencies, our partners, to see what we can do in assisting them in finding employment opportunities elsewhere within the federal government, if that's what they would like.
Stephen King is the Director of Disability Programs for the Defense Department, our first guest today. We will stay with the topic of disabilities in the federal workplace when we return. We'll talk to Dinah Cohen, the Director of DOD's Computer Electronic Accommodations Program. This is On DOD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Jared Serbin. Back on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, I'm Jared Serbu. This is On DOD. Talking about disability employment in the Department of Defense this hour. Before the break, we talked with Stephen King, the Director of DOD Disability Programs. Our next guest is Dinah Cohen. She's the Director of the Pentagon's Computer Electronic Accommodations Program. It was set up in 1990 to provide assistive technology to disabled employees in DOD. But as she told me at a recent interview at the Pentagon, the program soon grew to help non-defense agencies too.
Because we were doing such a good job, it was recommended to the president at that time, President Clinton, to expand our program to serve other federal agencies. So currently, we provide accommodations to all of DOD and all the services and 68 other federal agencies to provide the accommodations for their employees with disabilities.
And is that done on sort of a working capital fund reimbursable type basis, or are you actually appropriated to take care of all those
we
agencies?
We take care of the accommodations straight from our budget. So we make sure that people do not use that excuse they can't afford the accommodations and restrict them from hiring more people with disabilities. We really want to level the playing field and take the accommodation cost off that table up for that manager.
Mm. When you talk about accommodations, talk about how that process sort of gets initiated from an agency, or is it an employee that requests an accommodation? How does this whole process work?
When someone needs an accommodation, it usually starts with the employee saying, I need an accommodation to perform the task of my job. Many of them will know exactly what they need, but if they don't know what they need, then CAP starts off with that employee to do the needs assessment, help them identify the appropriate accommodations based on their work environment. Then they put in the CAP request form. It comes to my office. It gets viewed by our subject matter experts. And then once they see it's appropriate accommodation solution to meet their employee's needs, then we buy it. We pay for it. We get it to the user. It's just that simple.
Mm-hmm. And this obviously is for all federal employees with disabilities, but we also have a separate class is probably the wrong word, but a separate group of employees with disabilities who are wounded service members. And you have a specific wounded service member program, I understand. Can you describe
Correct.
How that works?
We found out very soon after 9/11 that many of our men and women who are being deployed to theater were coming back with devastating injuries, some of the same injuries and functional limitations that I've been accommodating for many, many years for employees with disabilities. So the first thing we did was recognize that, and we started to go to our military treatment facilities and just introduce assistive technology to our service members, because we recognize that this young group of men and women were born with a computer chromosome. And if you take that computer or that technology away from them, they are not as happy. Mm-hmm. They use technology to communicate, to function, to work. And so we wanted them to know that technology is still there for them. They just have different technologies. So we start to introduce them to assistive technology. As that concept grew, we decided that we needed to provide it, so we were able to change the legislation so we could provide assistive technology to our wounded service members, and they get to retain it upon separation, which I think has a real positive impact on their future employment and retention, because they learn how to use technology early on their recovery and rehabilitation. They get to keep the technology so they can start looking for a new job and stay connected with their family and their service members and their troops, which to me has been one of the key aspects to their recovery, is staying part of the mission. We hear that all the time from them.
What are we talking about when we describe the assistive technology that you work with? Because it's not prosthesis necessarily,
no.
Right?
Correct.
Because that's something that would be done by the military treatment facility.
Correct. We don't do what is called medical durable technologies. We're doing assistive technology that connects to the computer, connects to the telecom system, tools that one would use in a traditional work setting. So the technology we have that many of our service members have used, those who have lost their hands or have some dexterity disabilities, have used things like voice recognition technology where they can start to talk to their computer. We have quite a few service members that came back with loss of vision, and many of them have benefit from the technologies we use for our blind employees, which is like speech app, but they can listen to their computer. Many, of course, are coming back with PTSD and TBI. And some of the technology they are using are things that weren't really developed for that population, but they're benefiting from it. For example, something as simple as a live scribe pen, which you can get at Staples, is a recording pen. So if I can't keep up with someone giving, you know, me information, I can use that pen, take some notes, and hear it back later. A great tool for someone with TBI, but it wasn't really developed for them. We have people with PTSD who says, I can do a lot, but I find that I now think better if I can just talk it out. So they'll use voice recognition. Even though they're not have a dexterity disability, they find it so much easier to get their thoughts on paper by just talking it through. So we work with each and every one of them to say, what is your function limitation? Where are you having challenges now? And what can we do to support that gap between your challenges and what you want to perform? And that's where we can come in and have a tremendous impact on that service member.
As far as agencies incorporating this technology into the workplace, I mean, how difficult generally / expensive is it? Or does it depend entirely on the assistive technology that you're talking
the
about?
The average cost of assistive technology we provide in FY12 was $351. Not a lot of money. I think the value we add, not only do we take that issue off the table for that manager, is how do you find it? What do you get? What's the right solution? So even though the dollar amount isn't big and most agencies can provide that easily, it's just another thing they don't know how to do. So having that centrally funded program that has that expertise of how to do it, where to find it, and get it to the user has had a tremendous impact. So there's a couple of things that we do that makes it much more attractive for the federal employee with a disability, the service member, whether they're in DOD or other federal agencies, is that I, as a manager, can say, I saw a really talented individual. That person has a disability. They may need some accommodation. What do I do? You call our program office, we do the needs assessment, we provide the solution, we get it to that workstation, the person's a productive employee. That's where the power really comes in.
You said CAP's been doing this since 1990. Can you give me a little bit of a flavor of how this technology has evolved over this years? Because I assume it's been pretty substantial.
Oh, it has been. I think the biggest difference between when I started and the way it is now is that the cost of accommodations has dropped. The technology is more readily available. It's becoming a lot more mainstream. And the thing that I've also noticed over the years is that when I first started, you could only have one disability. You either were blind or you couldn't use your hands. But now we know that a lot of people, especially our service members, have multiple disabling conditions. So a lot of the technologies now work much better together. I think because of the high number of service members, many people say, what can I do? What can I develop? What can I invent so they can have a higher quality of life? So now the technology experts are working better together to make sure that it doesn't matter if I'm blind or I have hard of hearing or I have a dexterity problem, I can use the same iPad to do what I need to do. A lot of it's being built in. So I think that's where the change is. It used to be all that special stuff. Now you find a lot of people like some of the special stuff, and it ain't all that special. People are using it all the time, and that's where I think it really has changed over the years.
And as far as this technology that wasn't developed specifically as disabled assistive technology, who's figuring that out? Who's figuring out that this is going to be really helpful in this case? Are there industry best practices out there that you're working with private employers on, or are you guys kind of the clearinghouse in experimentation?
And over the last 20 years, there's been people who have come and gone who have taken that leadership role. Some of it has been very traditional developers, but some of it has been a combination of people with expertise in disability and the developers. A great example is voice recognition technology was really developed by the Air Force for our pilots, and that was done at Rome Lab, and all of a sudden we realized that being able to talk to our computer can have tremendous impact. Someone said, well, gee, here's a person at the Department of Defense who has no hands. Maybe he can use it, and started to think about it. And so there was a lot of combination of people who thought it through. Now I think the common practice is there's the Association of Assistive Technology group and leaders who are always talking to vendors. They're always talking to user populations who are always trying to find out, what do you need to do the job? They come to CAP. They see the technology. So there's a lot more conversations between developers, vendors, and the user community. So there's a much better bridges being built all the time to develop the next wave of technology.
Dinah Cohen is my guest on this week's On DoD. She is the director of DoD's Computer Electronic Accommodations Program. One more break and we'll come back to talk about reasonable accommodations in the workplace for post-traumatic stress and traumatic brain injury. This is On DoD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Jared Serbian. Back on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Jared Serbu. This is On DoD. Thanks for joining us. One more segment before we have to go this week on disability employment in the Defense Department. Our guest for this part of the hour is Dinah Cohen. She's the director of DoD's Computer Electronic Accommodations Program.
You talked a little bit about PTSD and TBI earlier, and I'm always curious how well understood it is at this point. What exactly a reasonable accommodation is for cognitive disabilities, vice disabilities that maybe HR people are more used to working with since the passage of the ADA?
I think there's always going to be probably a little information gap when it comes to different functional limitations and disabilities. Back in May at our CAP Technology Evaluation Center, we hosted, I think, a very powerful day of learning on PTSD and TBI. And we went through what are these functional limitations, what are these disabilities, and what are good accommodations? What do you need to know as a manager, as a coworker? And it comes down to, like everything, it's case by case. We find that many people with PTSD are going to want to have certain type of an atmosphere and an environment to perform and to be able to do their day-to-day job. There's not a piece of technology so much as I need an environment that allows me to work when I'm well to work and need to work. I don't need a lot of extra stuff, so don't expect me to come in and request a lot of accommodations. What I may need is FlexiPlace, because there might be some days I'm not going to really want to come into the office or able to. I may want my workstation to be positioned so my back isn't open to the door and that I can see people coming. That might be all someone that may need or want that may have PTSD. Someone that has traumatic brain injury, you assume they have some type of cognitive impairment. Could be just memory loss. It could be just like, I have some perception reading. I like my print larger now because it's easier for me to read because of my TBI. It may not sound like it's a logical connection for you, but when they have perception readings because of a traumatic brain injury, that might be all they need. So what we like to do is really say, tell me your challenges. What do you find it's easy for you to do? Let's emulate that and make that the way that you do all of your tasks. And when you have different types of tasks, let's see how we can modify that. So we talk them through the process. They tell us what their challenges are. So the accommodations could be as simple as positioning their desk differently. It could be something like a tool that helps them remember things instead of a lot of sticky notes. It could be, like I mentioned before, a LiveScribe pen that helps them take notes and not have to worry about every single word if they caught it or not. It could be a combination of that. It could be just a different keyboard that makes it easier for them to do things. So we really like to go and just kind of see how they're working and go from there. But we have found that most people with TBI and PTSD don't need a lot of accommodations. It's much more of thinking through how they want to do the task and if we can support their requirements with something simple and it could be just a simple adjustment. Mm.
This is kind of sneaking up on you with this question, but I'd like to ask you if you can think of an example or seven of, you know, an example of someone who struggled at their workplace, at their workstation before, and a piece of assistive technology made all the difference in the world to them and just increased their functionality in the workplace.
We have his story, which I'm sure he'll be happy to let us share because it's on our website. We even have a video of Matt Stain. He is assistant to the Secretary of the Army. He was a captain in the Army, and he got injured and came back with TBI, PTSD. His case manager mentioned CAP to him. So he really didn't know much about us, but as he was going through his recovery and rehabilitation, they mentioned, goes, why don't you talk to CAP? And he's one of the folks that uses a little bit of the LifeScribe pen. He uses voice recognition. He uses his eye touch to help him with his memory. He used to do a lot of sticky notes because he couldn't remember where he put things. He couldn't remember how he did things. And so it would just cause him a lot of frustration. And that's where this PTSD would really kick in. So he would get anxious. He would get frustrated because he couldn't remember things. So they were playing off each other. And now with these tools, he remembers quite well. So as he says now, he goes out before the Secretary of the Army, talks to the troops, gets the job done, and comes back and makes it ready for him. He found that once he was able to do that, as he says in his own words, I feel like I can be a very productive part of the workforce.
I want to talk before we run out of time here about Executive Order 13548, very important in this area of disability employment. Any specific responsibilities that gave managers in the specific area of assistive technology?
Well, I like to think that executive order is something that we can all strive to, and so we can all be that model employer. With that in mind, it's not just about hiring people with disabilities and making sure they have the tools that they need to perform on day one. But it's also, how do we keep them on board? A lot of us will develop disabling conditions just by the nature of us getting older. So many of us will not walk in the door with a disability, but will get injured on the job. How do we stay part of it? So a lot of it is also the retention end of the executive order. I think this is where CAP can play a very big part. I don't think people are using us as much in that area. I think they think of us as the accommodation program for people who come in with a disability. But we're always here to help individuals who become disabled, whether it's through the aging process, an injury on the job, injury at home. If they now have a functional limitation which reduces their ability to be as productive, then let's provide them with an accommodation. Let's keep the talented people we have on our workforce. Let's keep the people we've already invested on. I think diversity and inclusion is one of the goals of the executive order. And I don't think that just because someone becomes disabled after they got on a job is a reason not to consider to accommodate them. And I'm glad to hear most agencies don't think that way at all. But I would love them to use CAP even more to bring people who get injured back into the workforce. So that's one of the reasons why I go out with EEOC and OPM to do training on how to use CAP not only for hiring but also for retention and returning to work. I think we can have a big impact on the entire employment life cycle, and I think we've done that pretty well. In fact, we've filled over 118,000 requests of accommodation since our inception. And last year alone, over 11,000 requests of accommodations were filled.
One aspect of what you were just talking about is that I'm sure in a lot of cases there are disabilities that are not immediately apparent, and it's incumbent on the employee to let their manager know that a piece of assistive technology or some kind of assistance would be helpful to them. How do you encourage that process?
It's one of those kind of soft skills. It's like making sure that employee feels safe and welcomed. And I think when you have a strong disability program, a strong program that has diversity and inclusion, then that employee would feel comfortable saying, you know what, I may not look like I have a disability. You may not be aware that I have one, but I do, and I think I could benefit from an accommodation. If you don't have a visible disability, it is easy not to step up and say something. And if you don't need an accommodation, you don't need to stand up and say anything. But if you are going to make it easier for that individual to come forth, it's got to be because there's an atmosphere and an attitude in that agent that says, We value diversity. We value employees with disabilities. We know your worth. We know that you bring a lot to the table. So let's make sure that you have what you need so you can be as productive as possible. And we believe in that for all of our employees.
And last thing before we go, for people who don't know about CAP, how do they find you?
We make it real easy. We can be easily found on the website at www.cap.mil. So easy. And if you want, you can go to your Apple store and just download us as one of your apps. We try to make it so simple for people to find us, cap.mil.
Excellent. We will post a link on our website as well. Dinah, thanks so much for talking with us today.
Thank you.
Dinah Cohen is the director of the Computer Electronic Accommodations Program in the Defense Department. As we heard, they also serve more than 60 other agencies across the government. Earlier in the hour, we heard from Stephen King, the director of DOD Disability Programs, as we spend the hour talking about disability employment in the Defense Department and across government. That's going to do it for today's show. Glad you could join us. If you missed either of our two interviews or any of our past shows, you can find them at federalnewsradio.com. Just use the search term on DOD. Thanks for joining us. I'm Jared Serbu. So long.
You've been listening to On DOD with Federal News Radio DOD reporter Jared Serbu. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show on our website, federalnewsradio.com. On DOD, Wednesday afternoons at 2, only on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.